Welcome to another episode of Fit to Teach, where every week we provide evidence-based health and wellness information to support teachers and school employees on their wellness journey. My name is Kyle Pfaffenbach. I'm an associate professor of health and human performance at Eastern Oregon University and the director of the EOU Lab for Exercise Assessment and Performance, which we call the LEAP. Today, as always, I'm joined by LEAP intern Cole Jorgensen, who's a senior at EOU. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Dr. Kyle?
Doing well. For Fit to Teach each week, we provide a summary of research paper that provides insights into some aspect of health and wellness, and we also suggest an achievable action item that teachers and staff can focus on for the week. The goal is that by trying these activities throughout each week, that healthy habits will accumulate and you can find out what health and wellness activities are a good fit for you. So let's get into it. So this week, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you? It's been a busy week, but
I know. So we're week three. We're week three, right? Mm-hmm. Of our term. And I know the teachers out there have been going at it for even longer. Fall sports, full swing. My kids are super busy. My kids had career day today. So they're like out and about. There was a bunch of kids on campus. And then my wife is like, why didn't any kids want to follow you? I was like, I don't know. Probably want to be happy.
Missing out.
Missing out. So the other thing we're doing is we're taking our first crack at recording the video of these. So this is our lovely lab. You can see some of the equipment in the background. We're working on getting a better camera so that you can also, it's hard to tell where my finger's pointing. I'll never be a good weatherman. We're also working on getting a better camera so you can enjoy the beautiful view. And the idea there is that we just bring this to you in as many different platforms as we can. So right now we are on Amazon. That's probably the least used, Amazon Music. We're on Spotify, we're on iTunes, and you can find us directly on rss.com. And then we're also going to be starting to post these on our YouTube channel. So I think that'll be cool. So people that want to explore those and want to see that, and that's how you consume content, then we're going to provide that for you. So those are the updates. Today's paper. So last week, let's circle back real quick. It seems a year ago, but it was only a week ago. So last week, and this is an episode that posted on Monday, we really focused on this idea of how critical self-care is and how important it is for teachers and professionals and people with busy lives to take care of themselves. Now, there were a couple key things I pull out of those. And I was just having a conversation with this executive that's super stressed out and a bunch of other stuff. And I found myself like thinking about the paper from last week, because the general idea is that to be your best and to be at your best for your unit, for your family, for your students, for your colleagues, you have to take care of yourself. And we are oftentimes teachers, and the data suggests this, and talking with teachers shows us this, that when you're in a position like that, you give so much of yourself and you're always putting the needs of others before your own needs. And I know that's the nature of it. And I know we all have like too many things to do and too little time and all these different types of things, but we really have to be able to take that step back and realize the importance of taking care of ourselves so that we can continue to show up for people like that in the best way possible. And I think that's the biggest thing that we took out of last week. I don't know, was there other, or what was a big take home from last week, and how maybe does it segue into what we're doing today?
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what you said. One of the big take-homes I got was like setting those boundaries between work and home, and the fact that it takes multiple people in your little social circle to have good self-care and execute that properly. But
yeah, that's right. So we talked about how there were like levels to it. That was super interesting. There's policies that can improve your well-being. There's policies, and that's like almost at the federal or state level. And then there's like organizational policies that can really help. And part of this program and part of why we're doing this is an attempt to try and encourage self-care teacher wellness so that you can be your best. So that's part of that effort. But then there's the interpersonal part of it where your interactions with colleagues and other people, then your interactions with your personal friends and family, and then the personal part of it where you really have to like get in touch with what you need to be at your best and then take time to accomplish that. So I think those are, yeah, that's a really good point, that organizational part of it. One of the things that I think was recommended in that and is recommended across the board is around the topic of sleep. And sleep is something we did two seasons ago and we talked about it a little bit. I wanted to bring that back, particularly in this interesting, in the context of this paper in particular. So this is a paper by a few sleep experts that, and the last author, which a lot of times the last author on these main papers is the main author or the person that with a lot of times the highest level of expertise are the one guiding the vision of the paper or the vision of the project or that sort of thing. So this is a review paper. So they're just talking about literature that already exists, individual studies that already exist. But it's from a gentleman's lab named Matthew Walker. Matthew Walker is, I think, one of the foremost experts on sleep and the importance of sleep. And he's really working hard to understand at both a mechanistic level and an applied level. So what is happening within our biology when we get enough sleep and what's happening in our biology when we're not getting enough sleep? And then we're also thinking about it in terms of not just how it impacts our biology and physiology, but also how it impacts our interactions. And this is like where this paper went. So the name of this paper is Sleep Loss and the Socio-Emotional Brain. I would really encourage people to go look at this. So if you just search Matthew Walker, Sleep Loss and the Socio-Emotional Brain, you'll probably be able to access this. I think it's open access. And I really found this paper super interesting because really what they do is they show at both a physiologic, like a biological level, why sleep is so important for our personal interactions and some of the consequences that occur to a variety of different social situations and individual interactions when we fail to get enough sleep. So one of the things that I asked Cole to do is read the paper and think about what he found interesting and then have some kind of discussion questions that we can follow and turn it over to you.
Yeah. So I found the paper really interesting. And like we discussed before this, like it was pretty eye-opening how like loss of sleep from one night can have a snowball effect and cause a numerous downstream like bad effects to happen. So I guess one of my questions was like, how does somebody mitigate like the snowball effect of sleep loss and keep that from being a downward spiral?
Yeah. So let's back up for a second and just talk about that snowball effect that you're talking about. So there's a couple different ways that you can get to this. I think they did a really good job covering this in the paper and explaining it. So the first part is that we actually don't know from a biological or physiologic standpoint, we don't have great answers to questions like how much detriment is getting 1 hour less sleep, 2 hours less sleep, one night of only 3 hours of sleep, but all the rest of the nights around that night, I got 8 hours of sleep. There's a bunch of really, and there's a ton of people trying to study this at a very like, in a real like physiologically and biological way. They're looking at it in brain patterning. They're looking at it with biochemistry. They're trying to understand that. So the first thing is we don't really know. And so you'll hear things sometimes, oh, you can catch up on sleep. But then some people say you can't catch up on sleep and those things. The reality is like there isn't a clear consensus in the literature about how this goes. And I think this does a good job of talking about what we are confident and what we do know and the things we still need to better understand. Now, having said that, the snowball effect that Cole's referring to, and I'm glad he brought it up, which is this idea that, okay, so we know that sleep loss, even one night of sleep deprivation, can cause stress to the socio-emotional interactions that a person has in a day. We also know that stressful socio-emotional interactions throughout the day can disrupt sleep and disrupt sleep timing and disrupt how deep you sleep and how well you sleep and those types of things. And some of you are probably nodding, yeah, this is so obvious. Because like when you have a bad day, you may not sleep well. Or if you have a big thing coming up, you may not sleep well. If you don't sleep well, you're less likely to perform at your highest level. And if you're less likely to perform at the highest level, it increases your chances of having rough interactions, which then can lead to continued sleep deprivation. And so that snowball effect, I think, is very real. And I guess before I talk about myself or some of the things that seem to work, like, what's your strategy? Do you freak out if you don't get a good night's sleep?
A part of me does. Like, I'm somebody who needs 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night, or I don't really feel like I can function well the next day. So a part of me definitely does. And I'd say it almost create like this, what you're talking about, that stress, especially the next night being like, okay, I got to fall asleep. I need to get to sleep.
Yes.
And that ends up making me fall asleep later. So I do think it does have an effect on me for sure. I would say I try to avoid that by creating a schedule and sticking to it and having a routine.
But like when it inevitably, so like the best laid plans, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. It's Mike Tyson's best line.
Yeah.
And like I ran into this yesterday. Like I experienced this yesterday. I was here early to do some testing, and then I ended up sticking around and chatting, and then I made the mistake of looking at my email, and I got sucked into a little bit of work. And then before you knew it, I had another appointment that I'd forgot about, and I missed like my window for working out. And I was like, okay, I'll work out later in the day. And then it was just one thing after another. And I found myself not being able to handle some of the stressful or last minute things as I was going through that. And it was funny because we had just read this paper, and then I'm thinking like, I don't want to write emails or make decisions in this state where I'm like fatigued, unexercised. I've worked, I was here from 6:45 a.m. until 7:15 p.m. And I know you had a super busy day yesterday too. And it was one of those things where I finally had to say, okay, it's not going to be healthy for anybody if I continue to try and like work and respond, but then I couldn't sleep. And then we were back here again at 7 a.m. for lab and things like that. And I can tell it does take off.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, I completely agree with you, but back to like maybe something that kind of helps me a little bit is I try to find some kind of self-care like activity to do before I go to sleep that kind of eases my mind a little bit from the day.
Yeah.
So if that's reading, if that's watching a movie, whatever it is, like I'm trying to do something that I enjoy doing that is going to relax me and not keep me in the headspace of what's next, what do I got to get ready for, what's tomorrow looking like.
That and I think you have to just to give yourself a chance, because it can snowball really quickly, and they talk about that really interesting in the paper. Some of the things that appear to work. One is there's evidence that sort of forced breaks. So one of the things that happens is that if things are going well and you're working hard, and then you like, in the paper kind of talks about this, you misinterpret the severity of certain things. So you're more likely to think something that maybe you wouldn't think is a big deal when you're well rested is now a big deal. Or they have this really interesting figure in here that when people were sleep deprived, they had more adverse reactions to completely neutral pictures of people's faces. I found that just incredible. So, and I think this happens a lot because we tell ourselves stories about what other people are thinking about us, or the way what their intentions are in terms of how they're interacting with us. But we don't realize that those stories become more and more negative, and people get less and less the benefit of the doubt, and students get less the benefit of the doubt when we're sleep deprived and when we're not at our best. I don't know if you notice that. I definitely notice that.
Yeah, that's one of the big eye-opening things for me. Like I've always realized that a lack of sleep is not good. After reading this paper and seeing, okay, your communication goes down. Like when you start communicating with people, you're more likely to feel threatened by like certain responses or not able to.
That may not actually be threatening.
Or not able to accurately perceive others' emotions because you're sleep deprived. Like all this stuff that is an effect of being at a loss of sleep. Like it was just pretty crazy. Yeah. Like I'm wondering what your opinions are. Like what was the most eye-opening thing for you? Yeah, I can't believe this actually happened.
Well, before we do that, let's wait for that because I want to go back to things that we can do. So there's a couple things that you can do that it would suggest. And again, there's no one right answer. You just have to try and find things. But things that have proven to be beneficial include forced work timers. This is a really difficult thing for me because I get pretty hyper-focused. I think I have some tendencies where like it's hard for me to get started on things sometimes, but once I do, I'm like hyper-focused and I can't let it go. And it keeps like running in my brain. And so one of the things that you can do is set a timer, and they make these really cool just analog timers that you can set, or you can use your phone. And basically you say, okay, you can be on like a 25-5 or a 45-15 or something like that. Just whatever you think works for you, where you say every 25 minutes, I'm going to at least sit up, take a couple deep breaths, check in and see if I need a break or I could benefit from a break. And I think this really can be useful. Now, if you get to the 25 minutes and you force yourself to sit up, check in with yourself, and then you say, no, I'm actually feeling pretty good. I'm going to keep going. That's fine.
So you're not forcing a break.
Yeah, but if you need at that point, and then what you do with that break can be important. I think a lot of us do things like scroll social media or maybe look at something, or you think you try and be productive even with your breaks. Whereas like just for some people, sitting and looking at a wall is fine. Listening to 5 minutes of an audiobook can work. You're just looking for something to change the track of the way your brain is processing at that point, so it can have a little bit of a breather and then it comes back. And this seems to be really effective, especially when you're stuck on, I can't get the wording right on this thing, or we see this with grading. So this is important for the teachers out there. We know that grades change as you're going through a stack of papers if you do them all at once. So we just, that they've shown that a bunch of different ways. And so one of the things that you can do is actually randomize the order in which you grade, if you're going to grade everything all in one stack. Because like for me, we use a lot of electronic grading, electronic systems, and everything's in alphabetical order. So the feedback, the level of feedback, the engagement, all the different things, especially if you have a paper early on or an assignment early on that causes you frustration, you have a tendency to take that out. Whereas if you on other students that might not deserve it, and it leads to giving feedback in a way that isn't always the most what you're capable of in terms of constructiveness. And so when you take a break and you walk away, or you move to a different assignment, or you do something like that, it can be really effective. Yeah. There's one more thing. I talk a lot. There's two more things, and you can pick which analogy fits better, but because both of them are apropos. But the first is your sort of ability to operate in a day can be thought of as like a glass of water, a container of liquid. This is one analogy or one way to visualize it. And if we are, and it works opposite of a drain. So if you're sleep deprived, for example, it raises the level of the water level. And then if somebody cuts you off and that ends up affecting you because you're sleep deprived, it raises it again. And then you have, you're already behind in grading and you're already dealing with a difficult student, but then you have another incident and then you have this other thing. And then they ask you to do this one more thing. And then it fills it up a little bit more. And now all of a sudden, something that would be like a really small thing, if you add capacity to handle it, causes the whole thing to spill over. And so these breaks throughout the day and exercise and sleep and taking time to eat mindfully, those are the types of things that can bring that level back down. So you have that capacity to deal with the things that you have the capacity for. The other way to think of it would be the opposite way. And again, these analogies are an insult to biology because it's so complex. But the other way to think about it would be like, if your phone, if you just ran your phone battery all the way down to 5% and then it's at 3%, eventually, like, it's not going to go unless you take a break and charge that thing in and plug that thing in. And it's not going to charge as fast if you're doing a bunch of different apps on it and things like that. But even a little 5 minutes will get you another bit of productivity. And then another 5 minutes, if that makes sense. Like, you're not just plugging it in and fully recharging it. I mean, there's a reason why we say things like recharge my batteries and stuff like that. But we can micro charge our batteries throughout the day so we have the capacity to deal with the things. And then a lot of times you're just fighting to make it home. And then once you're home, there's another new set of stressors. So you have to take care of yourself throughout the day so you can still show up for the people you care about in your home environment.
Yeah. Kind of a thought I had listening to you talking just now. I'm curious if you think, I know a lot of teachers and even yourself, you're very busy and you are doing multiple different things. And I'm curious, like, I don't know if it would be a benefit or not. And I know sometimes you have no option, like you have obligations that you need to do. But I'm curious if you see it specifically within teaching and teachers, because you guys are such role models in taking care of so many different people, that sometimes you can get caught saying yes to too many things or making your schedule too full, and that taking away from your self-care, your sleep, or your like scheduled things that you need to get done.
Yeah. So I think awareness is the key here. And at least it was for me individually. And I do a lot of thinking about this and work about this, because we're not just here talking about like our own, this is what I do and it works for me, and so it's going to work for everybody. We know that's not the case. But some of these things in the paper, to keep tying back to the paper and how important it is, some of these things are like all of this is chemistry and biochemistry and neurology. And depending on the stimulus and the situation that your body's in, there's going to be an adaptation and a response to it. And so I think the most important thing in regards to what you're saying is awareness, not just blindly saying yes to everything, for example. And it's really easy to do that when you're young. It's really easy to be ambitious about that. And it's also really easy to get into the other habit as you become more well-established and you feel like you've earned the right to say no to certain things. Maybe you start saying no to things that would actually bring you a lot of joy just because, I don't know, you're sick of this or that. And so I think awareness is the most important thing. And for me, a lot of it comes from organization and scheduling. And I think that it doesn't mean, I have my own version of what organization means. But when I sit down, I put in my coursework, like when I have to be in certain places at certain times. But then I schedule specific times for specific things so that I can stay on task and be efficient. So I schedule my exercise. That's what was so jarring about yesterday, is like Thursday is supposed to be my day off, not Friday. And it just kind of, so I said yes to something and then I had a hard time like cutting it out. I thought I could fit it all in, but it didn't work out that way. And sometimes that happens. And then you have to be aware of that. Try not to beat yourself up about it and then make the adjustment moving forward. So every year I kind of learn. That period of time last year when I was super overwhelmed and super pushed, what were the circumstances that led to that and how can I try and prevent that? And then I work on usually in different scheduling apps, and I've tried all different types of things to try and make sure, even scheduling email time and scheduling. One of the things that has been suggested is that you should schedule worry time if you're a highly anxious person.
Heard that's interesting,
because you have this block of time that you're dedicating to this thing, And then you don't have to do it when it invades your space, or you say, okay, I'll do that during my worry time. And then a lot of times you get to your worry time and you go, I don't know why I was worrying about that. I'd rather not sit around and worry. I'd rather do something enjoyable or productive. And then you start to realize some of the constructs that you've created, that all those things are real. They're chemistry. They're really happening.
Yeah.
And again, this is not a prescription for anybody. I'm not a mental health professional. But I'm confident in, and I think that the literature would back this up, that awareness is a critical key to being aware of. So it's okay to say yes to too many things sometimes, as long as you're reflecting on it, engaging, and checking in with yourself.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a great response. Yeah, it's something that I think I struggle with sometimes, and I'm sure I struggle with it more than like older adults do, but because, like you said, they've established themselves maybe. But
yeah, I don't know. It's something you have to work on for sure. It's something I've seen a lot with the interns over the years, where you start the year and you're excited about earning this position and you want to do a great job and you just say yes to everything. And then I'm always really happy when we finally get to the point where you say, I don't think I have the bandwidth to try that this year, or I don't think we're going to get this done. And some things don't get done. And here we are still with a really successful program. Again, it's one of those things for teachers and admin and the people. That awareness. And then once you're aware of it and you're just checking in with yourself, there's no expectation. You're just taking time to check in with yourself. It can often lead to really healthy kind of changes, and that motivation or that idea that I just don't have time to exercise or I don't have time to those types of things. Once you start checking in with yourself and you raise that awareness level, potentially, yeah, if you're checking in with yourself and you say, I need more sleep, and you got to try and find a way to figure that out in your schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Switching gears here.
Yeah.
Another thing I got from the paper, it did a lot. It mentioned non-REM sleep a lot, mm-hmm. and it mentioned REM sleep at the end of the paper. But I'd like you to dive in on the differences in importance between REM and non-REM sleep, REM being like rapid eye movement sleep and right. non-REM being slow wave sleep. Wanted your opinion on that and like what you got out of the paper from that.
Yeah. So a lot of this is just coming from the same author that wrote the book on sleep. It's called Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. And really I think if you're interested in this, it becomes really interesting. If you're not interested in this, hopefully then this serves as your like boring thing to fall asleep.
Sorry, I'm interested in
this. Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah. And I'm thinking about like the stories, my kids listen to these sleep stories before they go to bed. And one of them is called History of the Toothbrush. And it's just this woman like talking about the history of brushing teeth. And she's talking so slow, and she's got this funny thing. She goes, if you like this, then you should read my other, you should listen to my other stories about standing in line, changing the motor oil. Like, it's amazing. And before you know it, you're just asleep. So if this serves that purpose, then fine. But for those interested, this is not my area of expertise. I want to sort of preface with that, but this is my understanding of it. So as we fall asleep, we have there's different stages to that process, and we have these different sleep stages. So you first have what's called sleep latency, and that's the time when you start attempting to go to sleep when you fall asleep. And people that have a hard time falling asleep have long sleep latency, and that is a sign. It's an indication of maybe we need better sleep hygiene. The flip side of that is they're absolutely so exhausted that as soon as they lay down, they go into this version of sleep and they sleep for a couple hours, but they've almost not gone through all the steps that are required to set up all the stages. So a lot of times those people will end up waking up in the middle of the night with worries and anxieties and things like that. So the idea is that you really want to start this process of coming down into these stages. And then as you sleep throughout the night, you go through these what are called REM, rapid eye movement sleep, and then non-REM, which is slow wave sleep, or like it, for those of you with an Oura ring or a Whoop or something like that, they call it deep sleep. That's the slow wave sleep, is the deep sleep. So when you look at your Oura ring, for example, I'm just going to pull mine up because that's what I use. And you look at the sleep, and it's interesting because I was like, when I read the Why We Sleep book, and the people that I talk to that are physiologists and work a lot of people say the Oura ring's the best like wearable that you can have for sleep. And then I go and look to see if Matthew, because a lot of what they focus on and promote are things that I've read from Matthew Walker. And then it turns out that he is like one of their main scientific advisors for sleep. Yeah. So it makes sense that it's a good tool. So you have sleep efficiency, which is like how much you're moving around and, or how much that you're still, you have your REM sleep, your deep sleep, and then your latency. And then there's another kind of factor here, which is timing. And they talk about that in the paper, how important it is to know what your rhythm is and be consistent with when you're going to sleep and getting up. That's really important for your body's like biological clock. So in terms of REM, REM is where a lot of, to my understanding, it's where a lot of like memory processing goes on, and a lot of like you're downloading information and working and you're organizing all the information that you took in the day and processing all that. Whereas the deep sleep is really important for muscle recovery and physical synthesis and these types of things. So they're both really important. We typically get more REM sleep than we get deep sleep. And like I said, there's different ways that you can track these things and try and better understand it. You can also, it is okay to not track everything in your life and just kind of check in with yourself and say, it's like when I wake up and I'm like, hey, I actually feel pretty good today. And then it's, I can't confirm that before I look at my Oura ring data. Or if the Oura ring is you actually didn't sleep all that well, you're like, come on, man.
Yeah, if it's something that's gonna like end up stressing you out more, causing you like less sleep.
And it can also be really insightful. Sometimes they do things like free month memberships and different things for a variety of different tools. And sometimes a month is enough to really try a few things and figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I notice things are getting harder for me because the length of days are getting different. That can make a big difference. So basically what you have is you want to be awake during the day and you want to be really asleep during the night. And when these things get turned upside down, the way it's been described to me in terms of like brain waves and things like that, you're like never fully asleep and you're never fully awake. And so it makes it really hard to process throughout the day. And all you want to do is go home and go to bed. And then you end up maybe not making the best decisions around bedtime because of your compromised like sleep state. And then you don't get a good night's sleep and it rolls from there. And the paper actually does a really cool, we just had to change it lines here. What happened? But the paper does a really cool job of talking about how when we are sleep deprived, our ability to understand delayed gratification is compromised. So we need things. That was super interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was wanting to touch on that a little bit too. You can even impact like your food choices. Like you want a more high calorie, unhealthy food choice over something healthier. Like that, yeah, that was pretty crazy to me as well.
Yeah, I found that really interesting too, because I'm sure people can relate to this. It's like stuff we've known, but then they're saying it and you're like, this is so obvious, where it's, yeah, I don't make great choices when I'm tired. I want fried food and I want fat, like whatever it is. I want things that are easy and I want, and then it's also things like purchasing and making these types of decisions or needing this need to close the loop on certain things that might not have the sense of urgency that you feel they do at that time. So now, and that adds stress, you know, and there's like chemical explanations for these things. That part of it was really, I don't know.
No, right. I agree with you. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. And then again, going back to the snowball point that they made, which was interesting, which was that if you make these choices based on the sleep deprived situation that you're in, and then you eat a bunch of junk food too close to bed, it's going to complicate sleep, which is puts you back in the same position. So,
right.
Yeah. Anything else? Any last things? We really want to. So I asked that and then I didn't give you a chance to. I'm going to stop. I'm going to let you. Anything else?
I think we covered the main parts. Something I also wanted to just, it's not directly related to the article, but we've talked about it before in class, is being genetically like predisposed to being a night owl or an early bird. And how I personally know I'm a night, like I'm not a morning person.
Yeah.
I'm a night person. And I know a lot of people can relate to that either way. And I was just like wanting to get your opinion on how that impacts your sleep and how we can, or how people might be able to shift their sleep schedule if needed, or if that's even a possible thing we could do that.
So there's a few things that you can do for this. One is there is a big genetic component, and it gets difficult to sustain for long periods of time. Now, yes, you can, as you get older, you do, even for people that, when I was your age, I stayed up till 3 or 4 in the morning and I'd sleep till noon. And that was like my normal schedule. It's like what I would prefer to be. I did all my work, all my thesis writing, all my homework really late at night. As you get older, you start naturally like shifting back. So by the time when you're like 12 or 13, you start shifting more towards the night owl. And then as you get older, you start shifting back. And it's a huge advantage in modern society, because so much of what we do is like morning into the mid-afternoon. So unless you're like a musician or a comedian or a night worker or something like that, like it's a pretty big advantage to have that genetic. And especially for our high school teachers that are hopefully tuning in and listening, you're going to see this get worse. Like you see this more in the high school population because they have more autonomy. They're making their own choices. And they're being forced to come to school really early. They're just really sleep deprived. And it causes this spiral that we're talking about here. So there's a guy named Jamie Zeitzer out of Stanford who is like a sleep expert. He's been studying the physiology of sleep for a long time. And he did a series of really interesting studies where he basically showed that you could shift circadian dysregulation or circadian rhythm. And this would be like a whole nother podcast if we wanted to talk about circadian rhythm. But basically what he found was that with pulses of light at a certain wavelength that pass through the eyelids, they are sensed by non-image forming cells in your eyes, and they can actually shift when your melatonin onsets in the evening and when it degrades and goes away in the morning, and it can give you a better chance of waking up in the morning. So light is melatonin suppressant. That's why looking at blue screens and not getting bright light during the day and doing other things like that can really affect your biorhythms, because when we get bright light, it suppresses melatonin, makes us feel awake. But if we're getting bright light at night or screen light at night, it will also suppress melatonin and prevent us from going to sleep. There are some tools out there. I actually have a colleague of mine from USC, and this is not like a setup, right? You're just asking me this. I want to make sure.
No.
Okay. Because I have a colleague. She was getting her PhD while I was doing my postdoctoral fellowship. She went on to Stanford for a postdoc, and apparently a postdoc in molecular genetics of cancer was too boring for her. So she joined the Entrepreneurs Club at Stanford and ended up creating a startup in collaboration with Jamie Zeitzer. And now she created a company called Lumos. And what Lumos does is it's a sleep mask that has algorithms that will feed you those light pulses to help you adjust your circadian clock.
Interesting.
So I usually wake up at 7. This week I had 2 mornings where I knew I was going to have to wake up at 6. So 2 days before that, I wore the mask.
This is something that you even use.
Like I wore the mask and I said, in 2 days, I want to wake up at 6. And so around 6 o'clock, it starts giving me these light pulses at these based on the algorithm. And then there's a 24 hour lag from when you get light to when it takes shape.
Gotcha.
And so basically you get up at the same time the day after you wear the mask, but the next day you're adjusted.
That's wild.
So it was originally made for like business travelers and jet lag, but now it's being used by athletes that have to travel. It's being used by people she's the smartest person I've ever met. And she's had several funded opportunities from special forces, and she's done studies in military doctors and nurses and night shift and all these different types of things. So it's a really interesting tool, but Jamie Zeitzer, the person that developed the research behind the tool, published a paper a couple of years ago showing that with a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is also mentioned in this paper,
yes,
with the light mask, you could successfully improve sleep, grades, daytime functioning in high school students that were having a really difficult time with early mornings.
Wow, that's really awesome.
This is one of those things, like if you want to create that environment to affect your interpersonal space as a teacher, I understand how tough of a sell this is, because it's really difficult to get high school students to buy into the fact that everything would be better. School would be better. Their home life would be better. Their interpersonal relationships would be better if they got more sleep. And I know that's a tough sell, but it's something that maybe like evidence, and at least to a particular type of student or a particular type of person that kind of is interested in how their body is working, this could potentially have a positive impact on them.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you. You've met a lot of different intellectual people throughout your life, and you're a professional yourself. So I'm always interested to hear what kind of relationships you've had in the past where you've gotten this knowledge. I like it, like when you include that.
This colleague of mine, her name is Bichuan Liu. She's the smartest person I've ever met. There were millions of high school kids take the college entrance exam in China every year. It's the only way you can go to college. And you take the test, and then you get, based on your test score, you get placed at, you put down what you're like first through eight choices are for college education, and then you get placed. And so there's millions of kids every year that take this test. They start studying for it. She started studying for it every Saturday in first grade through 12th grade.
It's crazy.
So every single Saturday from first grade to 12th grade, she studied 8 hours for this test.
Wow.
And then she took the test, and there were two people in her province that got spots in the molecular biology department at Peking University. She was one of them.
It's amazing. And
out of millions of kids a year, they take, I think, three classes of 50 to the molecular biology department, Peking University. And when I was at USC, I had three graduates of Peking University in my lab.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, that
it was
for example. Yeah.
It was amazing.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, that's a kick. The lights literally keep going on. Okay. Yeah. Anything else you want to wrap up? We think we went pretty long, but hopefully it was an interesting discussion.
No, yeah. I think honestly, we covered all the main points from the paper, and I think people got a fair amount of takeaways from this discussion. So I'm happy with it.
Cool. So we have a bunch of interesting things coming up. First of all, make sure to look out for new episodes of Turning Point. That's the podcast with Scott Carpenter and Brett Smith. They have two new episodes that they sent me that we're going to be posting on RSS.com and iTunes and Spotify. So make sure you listen to that. Two, we're going to be meeting with some of the health champions in the school district either next week or the week after, and talking about how we can best promote the services and the program that we offer here for teachers. You can see our lab if you're watching on YouTube, and this is the space that we use. You can come in here, and I think for some people, it can be a little intimidating. So we're trying to reduce that intimidating factor and just trying to get you in here to do testing and take advantage of the service that your school is offering. And then if you have questions or feedback for us, let us know. You can email us at humanperformancelab@eou.edu, humanperformancelab@eou.edu. And we're always up for taking suggestions that people, I want to hear you talk about this. I want to hear you interview this person. I want to hear you talk about this topic or those sorts of things. And we'll go find the papers for you and talk about it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Anything else?
Thanks for having a great discussion with me.
All right. Sounds good. We'll see you next time. Let me get my little outro here. Thanks for listening to Fit to Teach, where we provide insights into health and wellness for teachers and staff. Each week, we will see you on Friday for an... Oh, we won't see you on Friday. We'll see you next week for another new show. I'm sleep deprived, and now I'm making mistakes on the read. So, yeah, I got to set boundaries here. We'll see you next time.